This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by our friends at Squarespace, the easiest way to create beautiful blogs and websites and push content to your social networks.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 83, Benny Russell's Backdoor Pilot. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a new Bird of Prey replica from Diamond Select, Starfleet Academy class rings, and the Star Trek technology we would most like to have in our lives. We also delve into the news that J.J. Abrams will be directing Star Wars Episode 7, and what this could mean for Star Trek. Then in the feature, we're joined by Charlene Schmidt and Tristan Riddell to discuss the DS9 episode, Far Beyond the Stars. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week? Now, apparently you have cut your hair and you've grown your beard back. What's going on?
I've been gone so long that you can barely even recognize me at this point.
Right. Apparently those hormones didn't take.
No.
I don't know if you've listened to last week's show yet, but...
I was very confused by an email that was written to the show, so I must have missed something in last week's Ready Room because I've not gotten a chance to listen to it yet.
Right. That's when Colin referred to you as Greglin.
Yes.
Which, if you listen to last week's show, you'll understand what Colin was talking about. So,
I will get to it this week during my commute. No, I had a lovely, lovely time in New York. I tried to run into Patrick Stewart valiantly. I spent every day in Brooklyn, crisscrossing streets. Did not run into him, sadly. I did run into Jeffrey Combs at least 20 times, though, which was to be expected.
He is everywhere.
Well, of course. I mean... He's everywhere.
and now I have a new chair that is much less squeaky, so I am ready to talk some Star Trek.
Excellent. Good. Well, why don't we just jump into news then? And the first story we have is one that we have been waiting for here on the Ready Room. Finally, the Diamond Select Bird of Prey is available.
Yes, it is the unnamed experimental Bird of Prey from... arguably the best Star Trek film, Star Trek VI. It's very much argued. But yes, this is the one that could fire while cloaked, captained by the inestimable Christopher Plummer, a.k.a. Captain Chang. I need this. I need this ship. I need it now.
The best thing about the Bird of Prey in the Undiscovered Country is that this was the point where the Klingon Corps of Engineers, they finally perfected that explosion sequence.
Target that explosion and fire.
Fire!
Yes, I love that distinct boom, 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 boom. It's perfect. And what I love even more than the explosion itself is how uniform it is. No matter how many times you blow up a bird of prey, it always looks exactly the same. I do hope... I was looking all through this article for, like, a button. You know, like, Corps of Engineers explosion button or sound effects. I mean, I don't expect the model itself to blow up in such a particular way. But they do at least need to have that explosion sound effect.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I'm sure there is a button on the underbelly of the ship with that sound effect. And it goes on and on and on.
Oh, it does, yes. It's like that one TIE fighter in Star Wars. You know, the rest of them just go, boo, pow, pow, pow. But then the one is like, because it's the last TIE fighter, so it blows up with like a budget 10 times the other ones.
Right. Or it's like the last cow that flies by in Twister. The slow cow.
I love that film. Can we just talk about Twister for the rest of the day?
So this is coming out from Diamond Select Toys, and again, we have been waiting for this for quite a while. It's available now at your local comic shop or at your favorite online retailer. Now, who's your favorite online retailer, Greg?
What is my favorite online retailer? I usually go just... I don't like to go online. Online is not my place. I like to retail. I was actually, you know, given that I was in Manhattan last week, I went to not one, not two, but three different comic shops. I went to Forbidden Planet, Midtown's Midtown location, as well as some place like, I forget what it even was, this tiny little place. They all had so many toys. I was amazed with not only just toys in general, but Star Trek toys at these comic shops. You know, Star Trek's not a huge comic thing, but they had everything you could imagine, including like a J.J. Abrams Enterprise. There was even a Japanese Enterprise D from the 90s.
Oh, really?
I don't even know who it's for, but it's here at a comic shop if you want to spend about $150 on it.
That's interesting. I don't think I have seen that one. So, well, it looks like this Klingon Bird of Prey, from what I can tell, is going to run you about $70 if you are interested in it. And I'm pretty sure that the Try Me window box is going to give you access to that explosion button because, again, it is the most sought-after feature. You know, you can get a Bird of Prey model. You can get a Bird of Prey from other places. But yeah, you're not going to be able to get this authentic, perfectly perfected Bird of Prey from the Undiscovered Country unless you get this one.
And if it doesn't have the sound effect, I'm going to have to go to ThinkGeek and request that they make a plushy Bird of Prey that when you squeeze it, it makes the explosion.
Okay, that reminds me, I've been meaning to ask you, what happened to your plushy Enterprise? How did it get burned up?
Mine got burned up. I think you're getting me mixed up with Drew, who bought two of them. Yes. We'll have to ask the inestimable Drew Stewart next time he's on the show exactly what happened. Because, yeah, it's, you know, like toys used to have, you know, battle action scars.
Yeah.
It definitely something, it got tossed in a fire or left on a lamp or something.
I guess. I saw the photo of it. I guess it was on Instagram. Maybe it was on Twitter. And I wasn't sure. I thought maybe he was reenacting the destruction of the Enterprise from The Search for Spock, but then I realized that maybe he hasn't actually seen that movie yet. So
he'll get to it right after X-Men First Class. That's the next on his list, and then maybe he'll watch Star Trek III.
And I guarantee you that he's screaming at at his computer right now as I say that.
I'm sure he is.
All right, well, let's move on to the next item. How would you like to have an Academy-class ring from Starfleet Academy, Greg?
Well, here's my thing. I've got this glass of water, and I keep staring at it, and I want something to drop into it, like Noel Clark does in the Into Darkness trailer. I can't find anything. I've been thinking, like, should I drop this plushy TARDIS into it, this PlayStation 3 controller? Maybe this bottle of Chianti. But I think the perfect thing is a Starfleet Academy class ring from QMX.
Right. Now, I was just picturing in San Francisco on the grounds of Starfleet Academy, you know, there's the supply store there on the middle of the campus, and there's the Jostens booth in the supply store, and they've got all the class rings there, and you can choose. You know, what was your specialization? You know, were you in engineering? Were you in sciences? Did you go to the Starfleet Academy School of Fashion?
One of those. I'm not sure.
And do you think that admirals, do they go back and do they have their class rings remade after they achieve admiral rank so that they can, you know, customize it the way they do their belt buckles?
Right. It needs like some extra stripes. Maybe some shoulder pads. I don't know how they get those onto the ring. You definitely want your own specific admiral ring, though. I don't know. I do love that QMX says that the ring is lovingly detailed at 1-to-1 scale. So
well, thank goodness. I mean, I wouldn't want a ring that was larger or smaller than an actual ring to put on my finger.
I'm thinking like they could make it hobbit size. Maybe they can make one that can fit the naked giant from Saga. I'm not sure what else you would want other than just one-to-one. But it is a lovely ring. I mean, it's made of the you know, the best metal alloy that 1995 can buy. It looks good. Is this something you've been wanting? You know, people love their Starfleet Academy t-shirts. You know, water polo team 2161. Have you been wanting to just carry around a Starfleet Academy ring?
I don't know. I really haven't given it much thought. You know, I lost my class ring from university many years
too,
ago.
Actually.
And I was, for a long time, I was really bummed about the fact that I lost my university class ring. But then as I got older, I'm like, well, I don't know. I've been out of university for 20 years, so
right.
I guess it doesn't matter anymore. But I don't know. But when I look at this, I think, actually, this is kind of cool. Especially for $20, I might grab one.
Yeah. And it's the sort of thing that looks fancy, but if people look really closely, they can see how much of a dork you really are. I like that sort of thing. You know, it doesn't have to stand out. Like, you know, you don't want to be the person who goes to work every day in their Starfleet uniform, but you know, you could go to work every day wearing your class ring. And I don't think anyone would think any less of you. And plus, you know, if you get heartburn, you drop it in just like an Alka-Seltzer, you know, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief this Starfleet Academy ring is.
So some of the metallic elements come off in the water. You drink those and they kind of neutralize that acid. Is that how it works?
Something, I'm assuming. Can Noel Clark, can we have him on the show so he can explain to us what exactly he's doing with that ring?
Okay, yeah, let's line that up. I'm sure he'll be happy to come on and tell us about that. So anyway, this is available for pre-order right now over at QMX. And like we said, it's $19.95. And it actually comes in a very interesting case and what they call a floating vacuform stand.
Right. So if you don't want to wear it on your ring, you know, on your ring finger every day, you can put it in the little stand and it'll look really nice on your desk next to your plushy bird of prey.
Okay, Greg, so let's go on to the next thing. Now, we like to talk about StarTruck.com polls on here, which are always won by Voyager. But finally, they did a poll here, which is kind of series agnostic. This is simply about Star Trek technology. Although I have to say that in order to show the replicator, they did choose an image of Captain Janeway using a replicator. So,
of course they did.
You know, you got to get that Voyager connection in there. Someone posted on our Facebook page the other day. I've been doing more polls on there as well. Mm-hmm. And someone posted on there and they said, you know, Voyager would win this poll if it were on StarTrek.com.
Yes.
Exactly.
That's exactly right. Where we're putting this on there. Well, I mean, what they have as winning, I mean, the question is, what's the piece of Star Trek technology you'd want to most have in your daily life? And what's winning is the holodeck and replicators with 46% and 40% respectively, which those are used, I'd say, the most on Voyager.
Well, that's true. So, except on Voyager, you have replicator rations, though. So it would be like you bought the replicator, you have it in your house, but you're only allowed to have one cup of coffee per day, and you can only have one bagel every other day. Now, you can have all of the Leola root-based beverages or soups or sandwiches or anything you want. You can have as much of that as you want. But so, it would be interesting. No,
I really loved how the Starfleet engineers made sure that the holodeck was on its own power source.
Exactly.
But the replicators, no. It's either replicators or life support. You get one or the other. You're either all going to die or you're going to starve. But Captain Proton, just go, you know, do whatever you want. Victorian holo novel? That's fine. Go for it.
Well, you see, the thing is, on the Enterprise D, I don't remember them ever saying that the holodeck runs on a different power grid than the other. So what I think happened is that Barclay formed a campaign and he really, really, really petitioned the Starfleet Corps of Engineers to make the holodeck have its own power grid so that in the event of any catastrophic ship systems failures, he would still be able to hang out with Beverly and Troy holograms on the holodeck. And of course, Geordi was right behind him saying, you know, Reg, that's a pretty good idea because, you know, it's the only way I'm going to get any women is to hang out on the holodeck as well. So I'm with you on this. I think that's what happened. So when the Intrepid class came around, they made that change.
My theory is similar to that one. I actually thought it was a safety issue. That's what I'm going with. That they got so sick of every time they ran into an anomaly, the holodeck blowing up and killing everyone. You know, there was a holodeck malfunction like every other episode of TNG. I think they thought if they put it on a separate power source, that would isolate it. Sort of like, you know, how Google Chrome sandboxes every one of your tabs. They're trying to sandbox the holodeck so that, you know, you don't end up with, you know, holograms that are trying to kill you. Now, I don't know if it worked out. There still were a few malfunctions on the Intrepid class, but at least they made it home with most everyone in one piece. I don't remember too many episodes where they would just lose, you know, main characters because they got shot by somebody.
Yours makes a lot more sense than mine, I guess, from an actual engineering standpoint.
Right.
That does make sense. Well, third place in this poll, dropping all the way from 40% to 6%, is a phaser. And I guess that's a good thing that only 6% of people want to have a phaser available to them at all times.
Well, I mean, there's not much you can do with your daily life that you can use the phaser with. I mean, if you're cold, you could shoot it at some rocks to make a little makeshift coal fire. That's very helpful. If you need to, I don't know, get out of your apartment in a rush, you can cut through the walls with the phaser.
You're in such a rush that you can't go through the door. You just cut a hole in your wall and run out.
Sometimes the door is very far away. I'm just saying. I do think style-wise that old TOS hand phaser is really cool. I want one that doesn't work. I don't need to shoot anything per se.
Well, one thing you missed by not being on the show last week, you know, Thomas Riker, when he spent 8 years trapped on his own, he became a phaser artist. You could use the phaser to create artwork. You know, he did that whole waterfall. Yeah.
Phaser artwork. I can't wait to see that at the MoMA.
Next with 5% is a tricorder. Mm-hmm. Now, tricorders were kind of like on borderline of having those right now. You know, they have those attachments for iPhones that they use in Africa for medical analysis already, which are very clever. And a tricorder is something that I think will probably be a reality within the next few years quicker than we think, and it would be very useful.
Tricorder is sort of like a handheld WebMD. Like if you had one around the house and your partner's, you know, complaining about a sore throat, you just scan them a little bit with that little, you know, the little bit that pops off the top, and it'll just let you know, it's probably cancer. Sorry. That's what happens with the WebMD. I hope the tricorders work a little bit better than that, but it'd be really handy, right, to have around the house. You can just scan things, look for anomalies, look for, you know, cloaked people. They do a lot with tricorders. I'd really honestly rather have a tricorder than the holodeck. You know, video games are fine as they are. Tricorder would be the sort of technological leap that would really improve, you know, quality of life in a substantial way.
Oh, definitely. Now, the next one at 2% is a communicator. And of course, it makes perfect sense for me that this would come in at 2% because we already have communicators. I'm holding one in my hand right now, showing it to you on the screen, and it's called an iPhone.
Yes.
Which does far more than the communicators in Star Trek ever did. I mean, granted, we can't call spaceships, but it's only because there are no spaceships in orbit. If there were, I'm pretty sure that there'd be an app for that.
Yes, please dial into the Argus array. Dial into Echo 2. I mean, the communicators are amazing bits of, you know, voice recognition. You just have to tell it, you know, Wesley, such and such, and it transmits it right away. It doesn't even ask you for confirmation. You know, did you mean Wesley Crusher? Want me to call
no, the other Crusher Wesley
home? Wesley Crusher mobile? Damn it, communicator! But no, we have iPhones or smartphones of any sort that work quite well. I can't imagine wanting that too much, which does sort of lead us into the next one, which is Jordy's visor, which got a whopping 1% of the vote.
I wonder why.
Maybe it's from that one episode where they use it and it's like the worst thing possible. It's like, why don't we hook the visor, his visor, into the main view screen just to see what it looks like? Oh, it's a messy jumble of horribleness. Let's not ever do this again, okay? Okay, all right, thanks.
Now, I will say that technology that enables a blind person to see is something that certainly those people would put at the top of this list, and I think yes. As a general society, we think would be a wonderful thing to have. I'm not sure that Jordy's visor is the exact solution to it.
Could the solution to blindness in the future not be Jordy's visor? Anything else, literally anything else at all but the visor?
I do think something similar to Jordy's visor, not in terms of its aesthetics, but in terms of its operation, is a likely piece of technology that will be developed in the coming decades.
Probably.
But I also think that because of research into how to stimulate the brain and how the optic nerve works and also repairs to the optic nerves, that something like the ocular implants that he has starting from first contact is more likely.
That makes a lot
more sense. That we would have.
Yeah. And one thing I've been experimenting with, I've been watching BBC One's Africa, which is a nature documentary. And what I've been watching has an option for the, you know, the visual description, you know, the audio description track. And it's just this very kind British voice telling me, a view of Earth from space. Lens flares as the Earth glints off of the beautiful oceans. And I kind of, if I ever become blind, would just like to have that at all times. Just have a nice voiced British person follow me around at all times and just describe what's around me. You enter the plaza and it's beautiful. The Flatiron Building is in front of you. Wonderful people are walking by in red and blue coats. Am I the only one with this vision of the future?
It'd be interesting. I mean, you talk about augmented reality. That's
yes, exactly.
Yeah. That would be interesting. Well, let me ask you between the top two, because it was kind of a tight race, 46%, 40%. Holodeck and replicators. Between just these two, which one would you want to have more?
I'm pretty sure if I had a replicator next to my bed, I wouldn't leave for much of anything. You know, tea, Earl Grey hot, grilled cheese warm. You know, steak tartare cold. I would just stay there all the time. I mean, I guess I'd have to go to work to pay for the energy blocks that you put in, the raw matter. But that would just be wonderful. I don't care if it doesn't taste exactly like the real thing. If I don't have to leave bed, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I could probably agree there. I think if I had to have only one of these, it would probably be a replicator. As well, I would just love to, you know, not have to cook, just walk up, tell it what I want, and be able to put my dirty dishes and have them just disintegrate back into matter. That would be really fantastic, and it would be a lot better for me than, you know, having a hair barrette across my eyes,
right? Yes. Or Google goggles, which I guess is like the 21st century equivalent of the visor. No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, but no thank you.
So, Greg, let's take a break from news here for a moment and thank our sponsor, Squarespace. And I've been hearing from a number of our listeners that they have been checking out Squarespace and really loving the tools there. We've talked about various features in Squarespace over the past few weeks, whether you want to do a blog, as many of our listeners want to do because they just want to write about their daily lives or Star Trek or other things they're interested in. Or if you want to build a full-blown website. And what I wanted to talk about today is building a full-blown website And it's easy if you go to Squarespace because the system is so simple. And they have all these beautiful pre-made templates that you can just take and you can hit the ground running and you can have a new site up in a matter of minutes. But if you are a developer, another wonderful thing about Squarespace is that they have a full-blown developer mode where you can get full FTP access and you can get full control over the website the same way that you would be accustomed to building a website traditionally. But you have all that power of Squarespace at your disposal as well.
Yeah, one of our listeners asked us on Twitter what template you used for Trek FM. And I was wondering, did you use a template or did you just use the Squarespace tools to create something from scratch?
I actually started out with a template. I can't remember the name of it at this point in time because it was several years ago. And at that point in time in Squarespace, you did not have the ability to have full control like you can now with the new full-on developer mode that they have. So I started with a template, but I heavily, heavily modified that template, and I renamed it Excelsior. And so
nice.
The current Trek FM template is called Excelsior, but it's only available to me because I created it. But, you know, it's an interesting point that I did start with a template. And when we were talking to Squarespace about sponsoring Trek FM, they looked at our site and they said, wait, are you sure this site is built on Squarespace?
Oh, wow.
So even they were not certain at the beginning that our site was built 100% on Squarespace because we had modified the original template so much. But yeah. That's the power of Squarespace. That's how you can take these tools and you can use those to create something that's completely unique.
That's very cool. Yeah, I love everything I see about Squarespace. You know, some of my podcasts I listen to are also sponsored by Squarespace. And I hear, you know, just everybody talk about how great it is. People making, you know, personal blogs or people making full-blown like podcast networks or, you know, commercial sites. Everyone really loves the tools that Squarespace gives them. I couldn't recommend it enough. Anytime somebody asks me, you know, what should I use? And I say, you know, if you absolutely need something free, okay, but you really should at least try out Squarespace. You know, they give you that free trial. I think you're really going to see the difference.
You do. That you have to try it because once you put your hands on these tools, then you'll understand why everyone is raving about Squarespace. So again, if you want to build a full-blown website and you need full developer access, Squarespace gives you complete control over every line of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript on your site. You can use every template in their Git repository. They have version controls, which are standard, which is really important. You know, when you make a change to a page and it saves the last version, and so you can roll back. It's very important in development. You can connect via Git or SFTP. You can have access to JSON templating, and everything's even Retina ready, which is very important these days. And what's wonderful about developer mode is that developer accounts never expire while in development. So you can go in there, you can set up your developer account. You can take as much time as you need before you launch your site, and you don't pay anything until you do, because Squarespace is so confident that you can build any kind of site that you need to build on this platform, and it's going to be beautiful.
So do they have some sort of deal still going on for our listeners?
They absolutely do. So we want you to go and try out Squarespace, and you can use it for 14 days absolutely free, no matter what you want to build. And at the end of that, you can choose to sign up for the basic package for $8 a month, which gives you pretty much everything that you need. But if you want more, they have an unlimited package that's only $16 per month. And if you use code TREK1, you can get 10% off that purchase. That's just for Trek FM listeners. So go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK1 and try out Squarespace. You'll absolutely love it.
I met them in a swamp down in Dagobah, where it bubbles all the time like a giant carbonated soda. S-O-D-A, soda. I saw the little runt sitting there on a log. I asked him his name, and in a raspy voice he said Yoda. Y-O-D-A, Yoda.
Dakota. Yo, 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 yo.
Okay, Greg, as we move into movie news and rumors, we are going to have to cross into the world of that other franchise for just a moment, down in there to that swamp on Dagobah, because, as it turns out, J.J. Abrams is going to be directing Star Wars Episode 7. Now, I bring this up because it has an impact on the Star Trek world as well.
Yes. If you really want to hear an in-depth discussion of J.J. directing, you know, Star Wars, we did that on the Observation Lounge. And then literally Twitter did that on Friday when this news came out.
Boy, I actually had to activate mutes on that day. I was like, I just can't
mute everything. Just turn it off. It's like I'm trying to remember those movies where you can use your hands to push stuff off the screen. I just want to swipe everything.
Like
off
Minority
my screen.
Report had
yes,
that, I think.
Exactly. Right? Just whoosh. Yeah. But I mean, we were kind of expecting. I mean, there was that article. There's an interview with JJ where he said he's too loyal to Star Trek to direct the new Star Wars, and he wanted just instead to be a movie viewer, a movie goer, and a viewer rather than be the director. And he apparently did a complete 180. Does that mean he's not, in fact, loyal to Star Trek, if that was, in fact, his reasoning before?
You know, for me, and the reason I activated mutes on Twitter the other day was that I got tired of seeing all of the messages go by about Jar Jar Abrams and how he's betraying Star Trek. And you know, the thing is, okay, I am a creative professional. It's my career. And J.J. Abrams is a creative professional. He's a movie director and he's a storyteller. Yes, it's great that Star Trek is its own entity and Star Wars is its own entity. And there's Fringe and there's Lost and there's all these other things that he does. For him, it's a creative challenge that he's decided that he wants to take on. And it doesn't mean that he doesn't care about Star Trek just because he's going to go and do Star Wars.
It is your destiny.
I saw someone say that basically to do Star Wars or Star Trek, you need to have a deep understanding and appreciation for the material, and that JJ can't have that for both Star Wars or Star Trek, that that's not true at all. I mean, we had Ronald Moore. He made Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica, and that was just fine, really. You know, JJ's done Mission Impossible as well, which is another old franchise that, you know, he rejuvenated. Which with Mission Impossible 3 and 4 was Bed Robot producing. You can, as you say, he's a creative professional. He can do all sorts of things. And, you know, if he feels that he's up to doing a Star Wars film, I don't feel like doing Star Trek or Super 8 or anything else he's done precludes him from it.
No. I mean, I have a deep understanding of News Radio, ALF, Bosom Buddies. These are all different franchises.
Are there some announcements, Chris, that you'd like to make? Are you, in fact, directing a News Radio reboot for the feature film screen?
No. It's Bosom Buddies, Greg. You need to listen to last week's show. This was all explained.
Goodness. Sorry.
There's even a comic tie-in to set up the movie. Come on.
Into Bosom?
Right. No, it's
Countdown to Bosom?
It's okay. Countdown to Bosoms. It is.
Yeah. Okay, all right. I'm sorry I didn't listen to last week's show. I will, I promise.
So anyway, that's complete silliness to think that someone cannot have a deep understanding of both Star Trek and Star Wars source materials.
But this is interesting that it's going to be Bad Robot producing a Star Wars film. You know, it has been Lucasfilm, and now it was going to be Lucasfilm and Disney, and now it's Bad Robot and Lucasfilm and Disney. And it will be interesting to see what that means. And especially for us on this show, it probably means that JJ won't be directing that third Bad Robot film that he's contracted to produce.
Right. So these are my views on it, and we'll get into that one right there as well. My concern, I think that JJ will make a very good Star Wars movie. My concern is having the same person doing both franchises at the same time, because JJ has his own creative vision. He has his own look. He has his own style of directing. I'm afraid that Star Wars Episode 7 and Star Trek are going to look very similar to one another. That's my only real kind of concern there. Now,
I think we had that concern either way, honestly, because it's just kind of the way that sci-fi looks now. Star Trek already looks very Star Wars-y. I think they would have had to do a lot to make the new Star Wars films not look like JJ's Star Trek films.
Yeah, that's probably a good point. What I will say about this, and why I find it interesting that so many Star Trek fans are up in arms about it, is, and the fans that are up in arms about it tend to be the fans who don't like JJ's involvement in Star Trek in the first place. And as you just said, this probably means that he won't be directing a third Star Trek film. Now, they say he'll be producing it, and of course, Bad Robot will still be doing it. But you know, I also think that this means that there will only be three Star Trek films in this reboot, and that will be the end of it. So fans who have been wanting this whole Abramsverse thing to be over may have just gotten their wish by Disney choosing J.J. Abrams to direct Star Wars.
Yeah. And I guess they're worried about J.J. going on to ruin Star Wars, although it's already been ruined, so don't complain too much.
It's already been ruined, and that's not... That's a totally different case than what's happening with Star Trek.
It's so weird. But I do wonder what this means. If it does mean that it'll only be three Bad Robot Star Treks, and then what will it mean after that? And it's a little bit weird that this news is coming before we even get Into Darkness. People are saying it's going to distract. I don't know if your average moviegoer cares or notices.
I don't think so.
But we do have so many more announcements that need to come before we can know how to really approach this. I would love to see the next Star Trek directed by somebody else. You know, they said Ben Affleck was up for Episode 7. I'd love for Ben Affleck to do a new Star Trek. He's such a huge nerd. He's a great action director. I'd love to see him do it. You know, Brad Bird is out there doing 1952 with Damon Lindelof. His take on Star Trek could be wonderful. All sorts of ways this could go. And I honestly never wanted three JJ Star Trek films. I'm fine with him handing the reins to someone else.
Well, we'll see what happens. Another item that came out was a quote from Paramount's vice chairman, Rob Moore, who said that JJ will continue to develop projects for us, including a new Mission Impossible, and he is committed to produce another Star Trek. So that's basically the comment that we got from Paramount on this, and it just backs up what I think we already know and think. Yeah. And I think, for the fans who... I don't think it will distract from Into Darkness. I really don't think fans care if JJ's going to be directing a Star Wars movie a couple of years from now.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, but...
I don't think they will at all. I mean, it's just... Directors are, not to say they're interchangeable, but they can do lots of different stuff. Like, we used to not notice directors that much. I mean, remember, Empire and Jedi weren't directed by George Lucas.
Right. Did
you know that Empire is directed by the same guy who made Dreamcatcher? Like, most people have no idea. They didn't say, from the director of The Empire Strikes Back comes a Stephen King novel on this big screen. No, people don't care. They just go to see movies.
Now, I think people do notice the same way they would back in the day if Steven Spielberg were directing. I think they do notice these days that J.J. Abrams is directing. I know that's the case here in Japan, because in Japan, J.J. Abrams is huge, because Lost is really popular in Japan.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's possible.
But at the same time, like you're saying, if people want to see a particular movie, they don't necessarily care who's directing that movie if it's a story that they want to see.
Yeah. Ask people who directed Mission Impossible 4. I don't know that they're going to be able to tell you who it was.
Right.
And even with, you know, there were three Jurassic Park movies. Two of the three were directed by Steven Spielberg. Most people probably can't tell you which two. And the idea that people are going to be confused about which is which, that's definitely not going to happen. The only people who know who directors are know the difference between Star Wars and Star Trek. Now, does this make you more, less, or indifferent, excited about a new Star Wars movie?
It doesn't change my opinion at all. I was talking about this the other day and said, for me, you know, Star Wars is the original trilogy, and that is Star Wars to me. And I always felt that I know from when I was a kid, George Lucas talked about there being 9 parts. You know, I mean, that was always a rumor anyway, that there were 9 parts. But so much time went by that I felt like, and I don't care what he says about he was waiting for the technology to catch up so that he could realize his creative vision for the first 3 parts of the story. I think that he reached a point where you could only mine the original trilogy so many times to make money off of it. And he wanted to make 3 more movies to get new material to make some more money off of this one idea. So for me, I'm not necessarily like one of these people that says, oh, those 3 movies, they don't count. They're not part of the Star Wars canon. But for me, it's the original 3. So I kind of, this whole thing about making new ones, I don't even care about it really. I'm not excited about it. I'm not unexcited about it. I'll watch it when it comes out. But what I think is interesting here ultimately in this, to keep it tied into Star Trek, is that I liked Star Trek 2009 as a movie. I'm looking forward to Into Darkness. It looks like it's going to be a great movie. But as I just said about the original trilogy in Star Wars, for me, Star Trek is the 47 years of Star Trek that came before what we have right now with this Abrams verse. And for me, this Abrams verse is just an interesting little take on Star Trek from someone else. But it's not really, the fact that it exists does not change my view of Star Trek. And I just kind of keep them separated. And I think a lot of people feel that way. And I think that this is actually good news for those fans who feel that way, because it does mean that you can now see the end of JJ's involvement in Star Trek and possibly the end of the studio's flirtation with this direction. And the reboot has served its purpose to revitalize Star Trek, to bring new fans in. And maybe we will get a return to that prime universe that we all want to see continued in some way.
The prime universe or the alternate universe done in a way that's more familiar, you know, done as a TV show, something set on a starship where we just do stuff, not doing Kirk, not doing Picard, not doing that sort of thing, but just get back to the sort of Star Trek we love talking about on this show, which is stuff like we're getting to on the feature, which is these great pieces of sci-fi. We're not really in this for an action movie every 4 years. That's not what we're waiting for Star Trek for. So I'd love to see that happen. Hopefully in the next 10 years, we'll be back on a Star Trek path in that way.
I hope so. So the last point in use this week, tying into the actual Into Darkness movie and what you said we like to talk about, J.J. Abrams has told MTV News that the goal of Star Trek Into Darkness is to make you cry. Now, JJ succeeded in making you cry time and time again.
Yes.
With the opening scene of his first movie.
Yes. I just can't get past the opening of Space Adventure 2009. It's so perfect. It's one of those short films, like the beginning of Up, that it just overshadows the whole rest of the film.
Oh, yeah. That gets me too.
So if JJ can do that with Into Darkness, I will understand why they picked him. If they can do that with these classic characters, I'll be really impressed. And I'm just not sure. Like, what are they going to do to make us cry? Is it really going to be an emotional appeal where they're just killing off characters left and right? Is it going to be, you know, are we going to understand Harrison's plight? I do hope so.
I don't know. Maybe it ties into, they talk about the only family that Kirk has left. And we know in the comics, Matthew and I were talking about this on Literary Tricks this week. In the comics, when they did Operation Annihilate, George Kirk is still alive.
And
Kirk has a nephew and he has a sister-in-law. And we were speculating on how that might be a clue that ties in either to the movie itself or to the countdown lead up. But I don't know. I just think that they will somehow latch onto the characters. Quinto said that there is an insidiousness and ruthlessness and fierce intelligence to Harrison that almost undermines the interconnectivity of the crew, which does right. seem like they will delve more into relationships between characters in this movie. And that's what I'd like to see.
And this is where it sounds like what they were trying to do in 5 with Cybok, where he splits the crew. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see that sort of thing happen, really show the crew strengthening as a result of it. I don't want to see them really split apart, but somebody who's trying to undermine them, trying to get under their skin, sort of like Loki in the Avengers, that's fantastic. I love that sort of villain.
Yeah, I don't want to see them actually split apart, but like you said, Cybok, that's a very good example. That done effectively could make a very good story. During Black History Month in 1998, Deep Space Nine aired what was one of the most creative stories in the franchise's history. It was a story that talked about racism in the 1950s, but brilliantly tied into the ongoing storyline of DS9 itself. And today we're going to talk about that episode, Far Beyond the Stars. And to help us do that, we have back with us, for the first time in quite a while, a very sexy member of the Trek FM family. It's the international sex symbol, Tristan Riddell. Hey, Tristan.
Hey, oh man, I cannot tell you how good it feels deep inside to be back on a real podcast. Because it's
what?
It's real.
The hell are you talking about?
Oh wait, oh, this is awkward. I didn't mean real, like dealing with real issues. I mean, not like I don't like a Voyager podcast I'm on or anything like that.
Right. This is awkward because joining us along with Tristan today is his co-host, someone you may know from To the Journey as Casey Hunter. It's actually a woman named Charlene Schmidt.
Keep digging your own grave, Tristan.
Wait, but you're telling me Casey Hunter is a woman? I've been listening to that whole show. I thought it was just men on that podcast.
You thought it was just a man with a really high voice, right?
I don't know if I would listen to a podcast that allows women on. That doesn't sound like anything.
Since I edit the podcast, all I did was just change the tempo and the right. and the pitch, and then there you go. Casey Hunter Schmidt.
I love Coco.
Yes, all we right. do.
Okay, guys. So obviously, this leads us right into Far Beyond the Stars, which talks
clearly.
About not only racism, you know, and the struggle of Avery Brooks playing Benny Russell, trying to be a science fiction writer as an African American in the 1950s, but we also have Nana Visitor, who is playing Casey Hunter, trying to be a female science fiction writer in the 1950s. The first thing I wanted to mention leading into this story is that while I think this is one of the most brilliant episodes in all of Star Trek, I've actually had people tell me before that I'm crazy for thinking this is a great episode and that this episode is really nothing more than an excuse to get the actors out of makeup.
I call bullshit.
Charlene, no, tell us what you really feel. Like, what do you think about that?
I don't think Chris would allow that. We're supposed to be kind of family friendly around here, aren't we? I think I might cross a line.
You just might, yeah.
I'll save that for later, on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
So seriously, how do you think anyone would watch this episode and fail to see not only the aspect of racism that's being discussed, but also the dream of a better future, which plays into everything that Star Trek represents at its core, you know, Gene Roddenberry's vision of the future. Plus, there's the fact that there's the entire angle of Sisko's journey as the emissary in the story as well. There are three very strong messages going on here, and yet it seems to sometimes be missed on the audience.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a very special episode of Star Trek, and I think even by the end of the teaser, it's a very long teaser that's basically designed to get you into this world of the 50s and let you know, look, this is what we're going to be doing all show. You're either into it or you're not. But it's very clear that they're going to be doing some heavy metaphors and dealing with some heavy stuff right off the bat. And anybody who misses that, and the idea that it could be about, you know, getting them out of the makeup, that's just ridiculous. Star Trek is about getting these people into makeup. If you want to see them not in makeup, there's plenty of other shows that you could tune to.
Right. I don't know how anybody could watch this episode and not see what's really going on here. I don't think they came up with this brilliant story idea. Hey, you know what would be really cool is if we could give maybe Armin and Renee, well, and pretty much everybody at this point, a week off from the makeup, and let's see if we could make that happen. What kind of stories could we do where we could do that?
Right. Maybe J.G. Hertzler had a rash that week and they couldn't get him in the makeup. And so they decided that they would just go with this story instead.
Yeah, no.
So where did you... So who said this? Where I have never heard this whatsoever. And it's a little mind-boggling because, like, Greg, what you said, I mean, this is heavy themes and heavy material. It's not just a throwaway bottle show. You know, it's...
Right.
You know, I just don't understand how somebody rationally could say, oh, Far Beyond the Stars, it's such a throwaway episode where they just don't wear makeup. I mean...
Well, these are the same people who think District 9 is just, you know, a science fiction movie about aliens.
Yeah.
Well, no, guys, you missed the entire point of the whole thing. There are completely oblivious people, and there are people who are purposefully oblivious because they don't want to deal with the issues that are at play.
Yeah, I've heard it on Twitter, for one thing, and I believe I've actually had someone tell me this in a forum as well, as I've discussed this episode over the years.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, okay. Well, yeah. Let's talk about the actual issues in here. The first one, I mean, the biggest one that is most noticeable, of course, is this struggle for recognition and equality by African Americans in the 1950s. And this, like I said in the introduction, this was done during Black History Month in 1998. And I think they made a very good decision to have Avery Brooks direct this episode as well as starring in it, because we know one of the things that attracted him to Deep Space Nine in the first place when he read the script for Emissary was the fact that they were going to be portraying a black man as a father, as a role model on television in a very positive light. And I think you see that in Benny Russell here as well, even though in this story he's not really being the father. But then again, he kind of is the father to Serac Lofton's character in this story.
Yeah, he's definitely a father figure to that kid, as much as he doesn't have any physical relation. I love this Benny Russell character. I might like Benny more than I like Sisko, in fact. I kind of feel like all the time they spent in the Mirror Universe, they could have spent doing this show. This is a really fun show. You know, sometimes you have a series do a backdoor pilot for a show that they want to get made, but, you know, they can't get the funds together.
Like Assignment Earth?
Exactly, like Assignment Earth, precisely. And I feel like this is a really fantastic backdoor pilot for the show about Benny Russell, black sci-fi writer. And I would totally watch this show. And that's part of what makes this one of my favorite episodes, because it's just the characters they've created aren't just Kira without the nose and Quark without the ears. These are fully realized, interesting characters existing in the 50s.
They are. And what I love is how they kind of tie into one another. They're not the same. They're different. And yet it's a nice little homage to their counterpart. I thought that was done really beautifully. Sort of how there's that line where Kira's character in the 50s, Casey Hunter, says, "This Major Kira, she's a real strong female presence." What is the exact line? Dang it. "She's a fighter." I forget what it is.
Something
I
just like that.
She's a tough cookie or something like that.
Oh, something like that. Yeah. And so then the camera, you know, cuts to her and she's in Kira's uniform, but it's Casey Hunter saying it. I love how this episode does that. It's so amazingly good.
It was perfect with Jadzia. It's like, "She's got a worm in her belly."
Yeah. I love that. That was great. That was
also
a great line too.
On the street, Mark Alamo and Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
Playing the police officers was wonderful to have Ducat and Wei-Yun there. And like you said, Char, it was done in a way that you could easily make the connection to their characters within the actual Deep Space Nine universe. But it was also done subtly. I think one reason the story works so well, I think, is the cast. And I still firmly believe, and many people will argue with me, I still firmly believe that Deep Space Nine has the strongest ensemble cast of any of the Star Trek series. And I think that watching just the normal Star Trek episodes and the normal DS9 episodes, but when you see all of them together in this episode, out of makeup, playing these other characters, I think it really shines at just how good this cast is.
Yeah, you stole the words right out of my mouth. And this is something that you couldn't do without such a strong cast, such strongly established characters as well. And I think there's a reason why they did a story like this in, say, the sixth season, as opposed to the first season or even the third, fourth season. You've got to have that foundation to do a different story like this because it's a risk.
Yeah,
it is different. And you're always going to have that group of people who say, "No, I want my usual characters. Please don't stray away from that." And so you're never going to get them on board. But for the rest of us, this is something different. It's a completely different take. And I think they really succeeded here with it.
Yeah. And this is a show that only DS9 could have done. I mean, not even talking about TOS, but looking at TNG or Voyager or even Enterprise, they just did not have the cast to pull it off. They didn't. And they weren't talking about the same sort of deep-seated issues. I mean, what were you going to do with Voyager? Get a Kazon actor out of his makeup and have him play a cop? I don't. And that scene you were talking about with Mark and Jeffrey is probably the best piece, the best scene in the whole episode. It's so well acted, and they're playing, you know, they're so used to playing evil characters, but here they are playing very evil people, but not, you know, maniacal villain evil, just society has no problem with me acting this way, so I am. And it's a much more insidious kind of evil that they get to play.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I don't know if for me that's the best scene in the episode, although I definitely understand what you're talking about. Maybe from an acting standpoint, possibly. Yeah.
Sisko does that vulnerable very well. He where he's not, or I'm sorry, Avery does the vulnerable where he's not fighting back actively.
Yeah, right.
He's just saying, "This isn't right. You shouldn't be treating me this way." He does the same thing near the end of the episode when he's being told that the issue is not going to be published and he's going to be fired. He just does that vulnerable very well, and he's doing it the whole scene with Mark and Jeffrey.
For me, the strongest parts of the strongest scenes in the episode are the ones between Sisko and Brock Peters as the preacher, or as Joseph Sisko here, just because, first of all, Brock Peters is perfect as this preacher and this kind of inspirational person to deliver this religious message as it's portrayed in the 50s. But at the same time, he's channeling the prophets. And I felt that the writing and the choice of wording was done so well to make it believable that this was actually a preacher, you know, preaching some sort of Christian message in the 1950s, but at the same time, as someone who knows DS9 so well, you really can hear exactly those words of the prophets coming through to Sisko. And
true,
it was just really, really excellent writing. For me, those are the strongest scenes because they're the ones that connect with me in terms of their message.
That's strange because I can never figure out what's going on in those Preacher episodes. I mean, we can talk about it. I think Tristan sounded like on the other side of the room, you're kind of on board with me. I really don't know what this episode is. Like, I get the racism thing and it's fantastic. Okay. And the Preacher things are sort of leading me to that, where it's just like, I don't know why these scenes in particular exist in what otherwise I'm very much enjoying as a piece.
So we will definitely talk about that because... This episode is as much about the emissary as it is about Benny Russell.
Yeah.
Yes. But while we're talking about the Preacher, this is something unrelated, but about the Preacher. One of my closest friends is named Benjamin Benny. And I go to a Protestant church, and it's a very common to say, like, hey, you know, like, Brother Dave, how you doing, and everything like that. Well, my dad was addressing my friend. He's like, Brother Ben, how you doing? And I was like, you are the dreamer. And the dream, and no one had a clue what I was talking about.
Aww.
I was
like, aww.
And I had to share that anecdote with you guys.
It's a very obscure reference to make in a Protestant church. I salute you, sir.
That is fantastic.
Thank you.
That's excellent.
There are four lights. This is supposed to be about the Sermon on the Mount, Tristan. I don't know what you're...
No, just the stained glass. Just the four lights were coming through.
There you go.
Four Gospels, the four, you know, whatever. Whatever.
Do they call you the Brother ISS when you're there?
They should.
No, I mean, I'm the ISS outside of church, so...
I see. But yeah, to bring this back to TOS, I mean, Gene Roddenberry ran into issues just like Benny was, where he was trying to, there's the alien issue, but also with trying to put Midgel Barrett on the bridge of the Enterprise and have her be number one, the first officer. And they simply would not let her. And I don't think it's fair to say that the entire executive staff at Desilu and NBC were, you know, sexist. But it is fair to say that it was a culture back in the 60s that may have accepted it, possibly, but it would have made it harder for the show to land. And so it's something even Star Trek has been dealing with for years and years. And, you know, I don't know exactly what went into the casting of Avery Brooks as this commander of a space station, but I can't imagine it was super easy, even in the 90s.
Well, even with Chris, that you mentioned that we all know that... Avery Brooks was very drawn to this role because it was a black man in command, and he was a positive father figure. And with this, and Greg, you're right, it probably was a decision that they had to make. Or like, okay, we've done two, you know, white men in the lead. Let's do something different. Like you know, also, you know, they put it on a space station, which is something different. Let's push it even further. Let's get a brown man. And I think that Avery Brooks was the logical choice to direct this episode, because in every interview that I've ever seen him in, he is so adamant about showcasing people of color in a positive light on TV. And these writers necessarily, like, they weren't on TV, but it was still in the arts and in science fiction. And I think it was just a fantastic parallel to, Greg, what you said, with what they were going through with TOS. And even, I mean, we're not living in a post-racial world, even in the 90s and today. And I just loved how many parallels were in this episode, going back to TOS, going back to today, going into the future, 50s, 60s, 90s.
Oh, man.
It's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Not only do we have that whole thing where somebody in the creation of Star Trek said, you either keep the alien or you keep the woman. You can have one or the other. And, you know, I kind of related that compromise to what Benny has to do with his story being a dream at the very end. So I thought that was kind of cool. But then also, if we can shift gears just a little bit, Kira's 1950s counterpart, Casey Hunter, uses that name, even though her real name is Kay Eaton, because heaven forbid if people buy books written by a woman. And I mean, even in our modern world, there are authors that are doing this. J.K. Rowling, for instance.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it wasn't really until Harry Potter got big that it was revealed that it was Jo Rowling and it wasn't J-O-E Rowling.
Right. Right. And I mean, this is a direct parallel I draw between for DC Fontana,
right?
Who I yeah. did not realize was a woman,
yeah.
you know, until I really started doing some digging. And that's, you know, recent. Like it wasn't common for there to be a woman writer, and they didn't publicize it, even though, you know, obviously she was so good.
And you think yeah. about DC Fontana, I mean, Star Trek, the original series and the animated series, none of this would have played out the way that we know it today if it weren't for DC Fontana.
Right.
What's really, it's I know this was just a joke, but I was watching Futurama the other day, and I was watching the Star Trek episode where no fan has gone before. And I know it's just funny because Fry was talking about, he's like, well, you know, Star Trek, you know, taught us so many lessons back in the day. I mean, it taught us to accept people, whether they were Romulan, Klingon, or even female. And, you know, like, you know, you laugh out loud, you're like, haha, that's funny. But seriously, think about like how
right.
real that is. It's just like, yeah. like what Char said, you can keep the alien or the woman. In what world do we live in where like yeah. that's on an even keel? It's mind blowing sometimes. And it's still going on today.
Here's another parallel with they're writing all these stories about aliens getting along with one another. At least aliens are okay in the 1950s. They can write stories about them. But yeah, heaven forbid if you have, you know, a black man looked at as a hero.
Well, that's yeah. what Paps says when he tells Benny that he can't publish the story. And he says, your hero's a Negro captain, the head of a space station, for Christ's sake. And Benny asks, what's wrong with that? And Pap says, people won't accept it. It's not believable. And then Herbert chimes right. in and says, and men from Mars are.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Makes you think, huh? I mean, how are we supposed to get along with aliens when we can't get along with each other?
It's just, yeah, it's just like you can make the robot silver, but just don't make them a darker color. You know?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, no dark colored robots, please.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. So why don't we shift for a minute and talk about what you asked about, Greg, earlier, about the preacher and
right,
the message
right.
here. Because for me, this is very interesting. And this is an element of this story that I think you pick up on as you get deeper and deeper into Deep Space Nine. Because for me in this story, the message of racial equality and what is going on here in terms of the way the Dominion War is playing out and what Sisko is actually there to do, why he is at Bajor, why he's the emissary of the prophets, are kind of equal in the story if you look deeply at what's going on. But of course, the racial topic is much more prominent on the surface. What has happened here is at the beginning of the episode, when his dad comes into his office and he tells his dad that I'm not sure how many more friends I can lose, that, you know, every time I achieve a real victory, something like this happens and it turns to ashes because Kira has just given him another casualty report from the war. And he tells his dad that maybe it's time for me to step down and let someone else make the tough calls. And you have to think that this is something that Sisko has been thinking about in his head for a while, but he hasn't really articulated that. So he finally articulates it to his dad. And the moment he articulates that, he starts having these hallucinations that start to accelerate, and then they throw him into the 1950s. So as has happened previously on Deep Space Nine, when Sisko starts to stray, the prophets give him visions. And this is another case of the prophets reminding him of who he is and why he's there and what his mission is. And in the 1950s, the preacher is the mouthpiece for the prophets. And,
right.
you know, the language is crafted very well. You know, they talk about the Lord, the God, and the spirit of the prophets. And they say that he has sent his angel to show his servants what soon must take place, which is them telling Sisko that Sisko is the angel in this case.
I guess my issue is in reconciling the two parts of it. Like, I'm trying to get into the mind of the prophets, and why do you see that the prophets put Sisko into the body of a 50s sci-fi writer dealing with racism? What about that in particular would lead him to want to continue in the war? They seem such different things that are being dealt with.
Well, I think it's that as Benny Russell, he has to really, really fight for ideals of what he believes are right and what he believes should be the right outcome of the situation. And at this point in Deep Space Nine, you know, the Federation is losing the war against the Dominion, and the Alpha Quadrant is in danger of collapsing. But there's the line in The Office where they say the whole city's going to hell in a handbasket. And I thought that could apply to the Alpha Quadrant. That's what's happening. You know, the prophets have their need to protect Bajor. The Dominion, which represents forces of evil, are taking over. The Federation is losing. And Sisko's faith in his ability to guide the war and lead the Federation to victory and to see through this journey to what is right and good is waning. You know, he's losing faith. And I think Benny Russell represents that. It's the ability to show that he's in a struggle, but he can push forward despite the obstacles to finally realize a better future.
Okay. I see where you're coming from, certainly, with that. I still think there might have been a more direct parallel, like maybe put him into a war earlier on. I don't know. It definitely works, though. And by the end of the episode, he's ready to take back the mantle. He's a rejuvenated man. Maybe just giving him a different battle to fight is something that he can see that there are things he needs to stand up for and fight the good fight.
Well, that could certainly work, too. I mean, they wanted to do this as part of recognizing Black History Month.
Well,
so I would say that's the reason that he ends up here. But I think that it works very well.
I think another thing that would add credence to it is, you know, Greg, I'm kind of with you where, you know, when I first watched it, I was like, okay, you know, that was a very interesting tale, but how is it directly related to the prophets? I mean, is this really the most effective way to convince him to, you know, to go on? And it took me a while to think about how, you know, the prophets do never speak direct. I mean, they would they never ever tell him anything directly. He always has to figure it out on his own. And it wasn't until I made the correlation of, well, they have Weyoun and Dukat literally beat him up, and yet he has to ask himself, is he just going to lay down and take it, and or is he going to get up and go and carry on, which he may even fail again, which he does.
Right.
You know, his story doesn't get published, but he still goes to the office. And
does Sisko live through the, like, 4 weeks of real time of just sitting at home with a bloodied face?
It's only a few minutes.
But I'm just saying, in his mind, is he doing a thing where he's sitting there and we're just skipping past that? Or are the prophets maybe just moving him forward in time?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
Because that's a long time where he was, dealing with the, I got beat up. Am I even going to get up? Am I going to keep trying?
That's a lot of time to think about whether you do or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, but probably he does. I mean, if you think about The Inner Light on The Next Generation, you know, that was only a few, how long was, not even a minute, was it? Or a couple of minutes?
It was about 15. It was about 15 to like 25 minutes or something like that.
Okay, it was that long?
Okay.
Yeah.
But still, short time. But for Picard, he lived out that entire life. And
right.
And then we see here, too, that just like Picard retained memories of those events, you know, Sisko retains memories of this as well.
Right. So it's Sisko's inner light.
It is.
Yeah.
So you said that the prophets never speak directly, but they do remind him, like, earlier on in a session when he is unsure, they send a quorum line from like 200 years in the past who claims to be the emissary. And he wants to put all these weird reforms in place on Bajor. And then at the end, they both go to the prophets, and the prophets say, oh, yeah, Akoram, you're not really the real emissary. We just brought you here to remind Benjamin that he's the emissary. So you can go now. Okay, you got it, Ben? You're the emissary. You're the Cisco. All right, you got it? But so then he strays other times. You know, then Rapture, they give him the vision where he finds Baha'u'llah. And they have this way of reminding him. And then, of course, this particular vision of Benny Russell is really interesting to me because it comes back later, except it's given to him not by the prophets, but by the Pa-wraiths in Shadows and Symbols when they are trying to distract him from finding the Orb of the Emissary, which, you know, ultimately gives him that final piece that he needs to move forward with his journey.
You guys are probably going to think that I'm a little slow, but when I first saw this episode, I was just like, hey, that's really cool. Like, what if, you know, we're all just in the mind of Benny Russell? You know, like, what if Star Trek is really just that tale? But, like, when I saw it on air, I was like, okay, that was fun. Cool. Let's move on. And when we saw Benny Russell again, I was like, oh, crap, they didn't forget about this. Like, yeah. are we really going to go there? Like, is this really what's going to happen? Like, you know, this wasn't just a cool, for instance, a what if kind of scenario. This gives credence that this might actually be how the writers are perceiving the Star Trek universe. Yeah. And then when I read that they were actually thinking about ending the show with Benny Russell, like with a script in his hand outside of a TV studio,
I was like, I'm glad they didn't do that.
That either would have made a lot of people happier or a lot of people mad.
Yeah. I thought Benny Russell was going to wake up in bed.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, my co-host on TOL, Catherine, reminded me that there was an episode of Buffy where they're basically positing that the whole show is inside of Buffy's mind while she's in a mental hospital. And there's people to this day who claim that Buffy is all in her head and none of the events actually occurred.
Well, the same thing on News Radio. There's an episode where...
Oh, of course, News Radio.
They say that the entire... All of News Radio, the whole station and everything, is just inside Mr. James's head. And well, there's a snow globe and they zoom in.
Oh, wow. What do you think of this sort of thing? Like, I was watching The Following today, which is that new show with Kevin Bacon. And the bad guy, there's this whole scene where he says... I am now telling a story, and you are the protagonist, Kevin Bacon, and I just gave you your call to action. It's this whole thing. It's like the writers are like so inside of everything. It's like, am I actually enjoying this, or am I just giggling at how meta it all is?
Writers love writing about writing.
Thank you.
Writers are so self-absorbed, and so they love their craft so much that they just want to explain their process to anyone who will listen. And I'm jealous of writers. It's just, if you look at all of the history of television, you know that they're in so many writing rooms, writers' rooms, they pitch like, well, let's do a show where it's all in the mind of a writer. And we can talk about, you know, how the writer is the complete creative force behind everything, you know, this entire storyline. I mean, Greg, I think even Catherine was telling me that everything there. What's the guy's name from Law and Order who's been in everything? Like he's the.
Oh, I know who you mean. Yes.
Yeah. Like because he was in this one show where it was entirely in this kid's mind, like the series finale was in this kid's mind because that one cop from Law and Order was in that kid's mind that gave people the thought, well, if that character exists only in this kid's mind, then everything he's ever been in must be in this kid's mind, and that would include Arrested Development.
Right.
Wow. It's just so ridiculous how far people will go, but it's fun to talk about, and it's fun to, you know, argue about, but it just gets to the point where you got to realize, okay, come on, it's just a Hollywood inside joke. You know, it's not anything bigger than that.
I feel bad for Kevin Bacon now, because, Greg, now that you mentioned the show, it's going to be canceled.
No, I'm not. This is the feature. I'm allowed to mention things in the feature. It's fine.
You sure?
Yes. I've done the math. Don't worry.
Okay.
Just don't bring it up.
Just remember that little microfraction of an error, and you can totally like change the universe. I mean, remember what happened to Harry Kim in Timeless?
This is true.
Just saying.
You don't want to end up like him.
Yeah, you don't. What? You don't.
But let's face it.
You don't want to end up like Harry Kim at all.
Let's face it. The Falling was going to get canceled anyway, so it's fine.
Well, I do wonder sometimes if this whole podcast isn't just being imagined by somebody who's working out and they've got their headphones in and they're not listening to anything. They're just sort of daydreaming about what if people talked about Star Trek all the time for hours and hours and hours.
They create these characters of us.
But it's kind of scary because it means that that person likes to do barrel rolls in their own mind.
I always thought we all just existed in Isaac Asimov's head, but whatever.
Oh, that's entirely possible.
Yeah.
They were saying that Cole Meaney's character in this is based on Isaac Asimov, yep. where he's always writing about robots.
Robots.
Yeah, robots.
What else?
His homage to Dork Trek.
Yes.
And maybe Dork Trek is a part of Cole Meany's character's imagination.
Wow.
Now there's a thought for you. That dude is pretty twisted.
Wow. Cole Meany is so good. He doesn't have much to do in this episode, but he's always nibbling on that pipe. he's the one who actually got a novel published.
He did.
It's weird how much I love this ensemble cast because I think Sisko may be my least favorite, least favorite captain, but the rest of this cast is so, so phenomenal. And you can see it right there with Cole Meany not given that much to do, but read some script pages and say some things about robots, and he steals the whole show, at least to me.
You know, who I really thought made a big impression on me was Michael Dorn as Willie Hawkins.
Oh, yeah.
Creeped me
out. Oh, that was fun.
No, it creeped me out.
Really? Okay, well, maybe if I were Benny, I'd be a little creeped out, like, hey, stay away from my woman. But no, I dug it. I loved that character.
Well, no, I mean, I know I loved his performance and I loved the character. It's just that out of all of his performances in Star Trek, we never once saw him in quote-unquote human makeup. Where
yeah,
that we
true.
Only saw him outside of Klingon makeup once, and he still had something going on in his forehead and his nose, and it was just weird to see Michael Dorn, because I've never seen Michael Dorn act in anything else. I've seen him in interviews without makeup, of course, but I've never seen him act in anything else. So I was
This is convention Michael Dorn, and he's stepped off of the panel discussion.
There you go,
with Jace Masterson, and here he is on the set. Playing a baseball player of some sort. Yeah. I love how he's constantly coming on to Cassidy, just the whole episode. He doesn't even care.
Like
the
right
whole
in front of Benny.
Time.
Yeah,
yeah. Ben's there. It doesn't matter. He's grabbing her hand.
Yeah.
He's trying to impress her.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. He does not care that Benny's right there in front of his face. But then the moment that group of girls, he sees them in the diner. Excuse me, I have work to do.
But he's doing his own thing. I mean, he talks about how, yes, he doesn't have to live uptown, but uptown's the only place that's going to accept him. So, I mean, we've got that movie coming out about Jackie Robinson, 42. We're doing a mini version of it here where he's playing somebody dealing with his own issues. I mean, if Michael Dorn were the star of the show, this very well could have been a whole thing about him trying to be accepted as a baseball player.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
There's your other spinoff. You've got your spinoff of Benny Russell as a struggling writer. You've got your spinoff of Michael Dorn as a
It could be a sequel to 42. It could be 43.
And we could just do a whole show with Darlene Kursky. Can we do Darlene Kursky? Can we do her spinoff too? Just because I love the way she says, she's got a worm in her belly.
You know what I want to see? I want to see Darlene Kursky and Kay Eaton as roommates. And they do
perfect.
A sitcom together.
Yeah, I was going to say, I smell a sitcom.
Could it be like Bosom Buddies?
I knew this was going to happen. I knew Bosom Buddies was going to come into this at some point.
I was thinking of Three's Company. You could have Chrissy and Darlene.
Okay.
Okay, and that the punchline,
the punchline is always that Mr. Farley comes up and Darlene says, "She's got a worm in her belly."
There you go.
Every
interesting,
episode.
I think we got a winner.
Yeah, it's interesting, but disgusting.
Like, she somehow works that line into every single episode. That's genius.
That would be, wouldn't
everybody
it?
It's like Kramer showing up and everybody claps.
And yeah. She Woo! Always looks directly at the camera when she delivers the line.
Yeah.
They zoom in on her. It's like all the action stops.
She's just ditzily twirling around in her gum with her accent.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you guys who your favorite in-universe character is out of all the... I mean, assuming we're accepting Benny Russell, who would you guys really like to see a spinoff done of?
Armin Shimerman and... And Renee Auberjonois's character, because I love that they kept the love-hate relationship going on even in the 1953 universe.
So good.
Because it was just like he threatened to quit, and he's like, "I'll bring you crawlers next time." And he's like, "Okay, I'll stay." You know, it's just fantastic so writing good. And delivery.
Yeah. So I mean, perfect.
The delivery was absolutely perfect, and so I love that dynamic.
I think for me, do you guys remember on an old Saturday Night Live when Patrick Stewart hosted? And he ran an erotic cake shop. And people would come in.
I do not remember this.
I do.
People would come in to buy cakes, and all of his cakes had an erotic theme. I'd like to see a spinoff of J.G. Hertzler as the erotic artist. He would have an erotic art shop where people would come in to commission ordinary artwork from him. But when they would come back to pick it up, it would always have an erotic theme. Just like the the illustrations that he was showing them there. Yeah. What did he have? He had the honeymoon on Andoris.
Right. Yes. I don't even want to know what was going on there.
Yeah, it was like
some really bizarre bodice-ripping novel.
It was a gigantic praying mantis and a pinup girl with a torn, you know, outfit. Right. I don't even know how I don't even want to know how that works. Like
I
did
know.
Like his space age version of Deep Space Nine. I think it's a pretty, pretty ship.
Yes.
Yeah, for 2001. Yeah.
That had U.S. Air Force ship. On the side of it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that was so cool.
So I would hang that up. I would frame that and hang it up if I could find a decent print of that.
Someone needs to make a poster.
Yes. Do we know who did that art?
John Eaves.
Oh,
wow.
Okay.
It's so good.
Yeah, I loved it.
Well, what about you, Charlene? Who would you like to see a spinoff of?
Well, I mean, I don't know if you can top, the Odo and Quark counterpart spinoff. That's so good. But then, I don't know, I really dug Nana Visitor playing Kay Eaton. She's got her bite, and yet it's a little different. I just really loved how that translated between her and Kira.
Well, she's a tough cookie.
She is a tough cookie, and I like that.
What about a spinoff of her and Kira as crime fighters? It could be like on
ooh, a cop show.
And their overall arch nemesis is the Intendant.
Yes, that's right. So that would be like, it'd be like on 30 Rock when Tracy Jordan wants to play every character in his documentary about Jefferson. It'd be like that. Except it'd be Nana Visitor and she would be playing Kay Eaton, Kira, and the Intendant.
I could go for that.
I'd do that. I'd buy that on pay-per-view.
Oh, goodness.
I bet you would.
On Cinemax. Or Showtime.
Hey.
What I'd really love to see is Jeffrey Combs and Mark Limo. But their characters, in the pilot episode, they realize the error of their ways. You know, they go through this journey where they go from being racist cops to then being the only non-racist cops in New York. And they go around and they fight injustice wherever they can.
Or, hey, I got another idea. We follow Jimmy and his misadventures in his career of crime.
And at the end of every episode, he gets shot by the cops.
Sort of like how they kill Kenny in South Park every week. Oh, my God, like. You killed Jimmy! You bastards!
That would... Or like, I don't know if you guys know, of course you know Garrison Keillor, but he did these sketches on Prairie Home Companion called Guy Noir. And at the end of Guy Noir, he always gets shot. His best friend always shoots him at the end of every sketch. And he's like, "Oh man, you shot me again."
Yeah, just when you think Jimmy's about to get away with it, boom.
Boom.
Or we could have the boringest spinoff of all time and have Aaron Eisenberg's character be followed, where it's just him shouting on a street corner selling papers. And then it turns into Newsies all of a sudden.
Right.
Well,
Christian Bale shows up.
He just starts singing Santa Fe.
Then in the third season, he gets a bicycle. And then he gets a bike route and a paper route, and he starts delivering. They have to amp it up, and they change the theme music for the show. You know, they put a little driving bass in there.
And we follow his career, and he becomes a newspaper tycoon, but then it all gets brought down because of the digital revolution. Okay, maybe this wouldn't be the boring spinoff.
No, I love this. I love this. I just want to see Aaron Eisenberg saying, "The way of the future. The way of the future. The way of the future."
There's so much potential here. I love it.
That could even be a
great
ringtone.
And they only did two episodes in this world. I don't know. Why did they not mine this over and over and over again?
All right. Well, why don't we bring it back to the story a little bit on a serious note again? And another thing to talk about here, Shar, you asked me if this is the perfect sci-fi story, because this is one of the rare stories in Star Trek that I feel works really as a science fiction story, as like a classic SF tale, not just as a Star Trek story. There are a few like that. And of course, you could argue here that it doesn't work that way, because without the space station, without the Star Trek elements, maybe this story doesn't have the same connection. But you could certainly tell all the stuff that takes place in the 50s, all the stuff about Benny Russell, you could definitely tell an entire story about that if you stripped out the Star Trek elements. But what do you guys think about that?
I think it's darn close to being perfect. This is probably, I'll just kind of take a little thing from my final thoughts and put it here. This is in my top five because it is that good, I think. Everything ties together so beautifully. I don't know if you can make it any better. I really don't. I think it works perfectly fine as a standalone story. Say if somebody wrote this as a short story, you wouldn't necessarily need Deep Space Nine to do it. But I think it's better for it being a Deep Space Nine story and using the characters that we love to show this alternate story using our characters.
Charlin, I'm with you on this one. I feel like it's a great science fiction story, but you know, you could easily take out the science fiction aspect and still have a good story that can stand on its own merits. And I really enjoy Star Trek episodes where you could only tell stories through a sci-fi lens. I enjoy when I see that, but I also like seeing stories like this where we have just a great story that could be told in any show, well, any good drama, but that is coated with some nice science fiction, because that's the world that we all know and love, and that's why we're all talking about it on this podcast right now.
Right. Yeah, I kind of equate this with City on the Edge of Forever as kind of that pinnacle of a really good sci-fi story, period.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, it's not, if you take away the DS9 aspect, it's a really good show about the 50s. You know, this could be an episode of Mad Men, honestly. But then add in the stuff with DS9, it's a really great episode of Star Trek. I definitely I'd put it up there with City on the Edge of Forever. And I really appreciate that they don't do a technobabble explanation for it at the end.
Yes.
Like, if it had been Voyager, there would have been some stupid thing. But
it would have been bad.
You sort of have to, assume the prophets did something. It doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. What matters is what happened on the screen and what brought Sisko from here to there. And that just is part of what also makes it so perfect.
That's what bothers me about, there's certain people in this world, and Greg, you were explaining these type of people in this world who just don't get it and can't understand it. I remember I saw Benjamin Button in the theater, and as I was walking out, I'm discussing it with my wife, and we were just talking about how amazing it was, and how we love the story, and I heard these two teenagers bitching behind me, like, but they didn't explain why he was aging backwards, so just couldn't get into it. I'm like, wow, that was totally the point of it. You know, and
you should have said, because F. Scott Fitzgerald, and punched him in the face.
Boom, roasted.
That's why.
Yeah. Well, maybe they apparently needed the technobabble explanation. Go watch Voyager then.
I guess.
Because that's what you would get. I love Voyager. I have to say that. But
yeah, you better say
man,
that.
And I do. I really genuinely do. But I'm so glad that they didn't go this route with this story, because it really would have ruined it. We don't need to know that. No. Yeah. It's better left a mystery.
Well, it's much more mysticism in Deep Space Nine than any other show.
True.
And that's the way I like it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A good parallel to this in Voyager, I think, is one we did on here not too long ago, which is 1159, which is another story where they actually step out of that for a little bit to tell a story that's just a good character story and a good science fiction story that, it does tie back into Star Trek a little bit. It actually ties back into Star Trek less than this story does, I think. So you guys mentioned The City on the Edge of Forever. Also from DS9, The Visitor. I think 1159 from Voyager are all very good examples of this.
Yeah, and part of it is that this episode can stand on its own. You don't really have to know anything about DS9 to get into it. This is one that they could sell as like a standalone DVD, and you could just give it to your friends and say, check this out. This is what Star Trek can actually do to somebody who doesn't know anything about Star Trek, really.
And there actually is a very good novelization of this episode, which I haven't read.
Oh, that'd
read.
Be great to read.
Yeah,
it's really good. I haven't read it in a really long time, but I remember when I did read it, feeling how it made this episode even better, because it wasn't one of those novelizations where they just basically tell you the episode. They really expanded upon the ideas in the episode a lot more because they had more time to do it in the book. Yeah, you should pick up that one.
It's really good.
It may be fun and a good idea to hand people this episode, but about like an hour before I got on this podcast, I was trying to explain the episode to my wife, Sarah, and after, like, I'd say, like, and, you know, he was cut off from the prophets, and, like, I mean, like, this came up later when he was cut off from the prophets, and he was trying to find this orb, and she's like, and what does that mean? I'm like, what do you mean? Cut off from the prophets. How do you not know what that means? You know, it's just, there's just so many little details that
I think
it's hard.
I think that's a case where, like what Greg is saying, is that you could watch this and know nothing about DS9 and you would still enjoy this very good, very interesting story about Benny Russell. But if you know DS9, there's this entire other level to the story that you also get.
Right. You see a completely different layer than if you're a complete newbie, but you can still enjoy it as a newbie.
So one of the last things that I wanted to ask you guys about was when they're debating about how to get the story published, and it suggested that why don't we make it all a dream at the end? And I'm not talking about the episode, I'm talking about Benny Russell's story. And then Paps is thinking for a minute, maybe that'll work. And Herbert says making it a dream guts the story. And Julius says that he thinks it makes it more poignant. What do you guys think?
Well, I just watched These Are the Voyages.
Oh, boy.
But that's not a dream. That's Riker's historical holodeck fetish going on right there.
Right. His Riker's historical fan fiction. But I think it is sort of the same thing. Like, when you're in the writer's room, does it make it more poignant for this to be Riker in the holodeck? Or does it gut the story? Does it take you out of the reality of the fiction? I think it absolutely does gut the story in the case of Benny's story. If you have it all be a dream, it makes it matter less. And that's the whole point, that they think, well, they end up not being able to get it past Mr. Stone. But the whole point is they think they can get it past people by saying, look, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. The guy's really a shoeshine boy. So he's not going to amount to anything. He's just having these crazy delusions.
I don't know if it guts the story entirely. I don't know if it makes it more poignant. In fact, I would say that it doesn't. but I just saw that as kind of the real world compromise. You want this story published, you're going to have to make this concession, but it's still better than chalk on the sidewalk.
I'm going to have to give the political answer and say I can see both sides.
All right, Senator, go ahead.
I can see both sides of the argument, where I agree with Charlene, where I don't think it adds anything to it, but I don't think it detracts. But at the same, I don't know, because I like the idea of it all being a dream, because it shows that this guy who was having the dream is in a harsh reality, and he's dreaming of a future that's better, and we should all dream of a future that's better so that we can make it happen. But at the same time, I can see, like, no, we should say this is the future that needs to happen, and this will happen if we focus on it. And so, like I said, I can see both ways. I would much rather it be like, no, this is really going to happen, than a dream, because everything that I watched, there's so, like, if you think about it, I think I see about 3 episodes a year of something where, oh, it was just a dream. Like, even Home Improvement had an episode where it was all just a dream.
They did, really? Oh my God.
And I don't know. I mean, at the same time, you're like, oh, okay, cool. I'm so glad that that didn't happen. Then you're like, hey, Stewie didn't really kill Lois. What's the deal?
Right. I think the point where they took that too far was that episode of The Price is Right, where the woman got $1 on the wheel. Yeah. And then she won both showcases. And then at the end, Bob Barker woke up in bed and it was all a dream. It was just too much for me.
That's going to happen to Ken Jennings any minute now. He's going to wake up and realize, I'm not a 75-time Jeopardy champion. Oh my God, I don't amount to anything. Oh. Take away his Twitter followers, it's going to be awful.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm pretty much of the same thought as Tristan here. I think it depends on the perspective. On the one hand, yeah, so science fiction, and here we're talking about a science fiction publication in the 1950s, kind of the golden age of sci-fi, a social commentary, and they are talking about this future, this black captain of a space station 400 years in the future. And so to say that, yes, this is what the future will really be like, is a great way to take the story. And it sends a strong message. And you can kind of use that to try to persuade people that, yes, this is where the future is heading. And, you know, you should get on board with it because this is the evolution of the society. At the same time, saying that it's just a dream at the end, I don't think it completely guts the story either, because a lot of what science fiction is and what Star Trek is this dream of a better future. And, you know, we have to dream things before we can achieve them. I think that what would have been interesting would be, in the first story, perhaps it was just a dream, but if Benny Russell continued to write the story, that could then evolve and he could establish it not as a dream, but take it more into a real future. I don't know exactly how that would have played out, but it would have been a very interesting thing to see, like, a series of stories written by Benny Russell about this. In fact, they should have, Pocketbook should have done a book series of books penned by Benny Russell.
Totally.
Well, they've done that so many times. Like, they have the book from Californication, God Hates Us All. Somebody wrote that and published it. There's Castle Books, as if they were written by Nathan Fillion's character. So yeah, absolutely. Go do a whole bunch of Benny Russell novels along with that series of Captain Proton audio books that still need to be made.
That Dayton's going to write, right?
Yes.
There we go.
Well, we're about to hit an hour here. I think we've had a great discussion of this episode. There's so much to talk about here. We could actually do an entire show only about Benny. We could do an entire show only about the emissary angle of it as well. I have a few things I still wanted to touch on. I have a few things I still wanted to touch on in my final thoughts, but before we do that, why don't you guys jump into your final thoughts? How about Tristan, why don't you kick us off?
Well, I feel like this is an episode that when I first saw it, I immediately loved it, and I thought it was very good, and I moved on from it. And it wasn't until multiple viewings and seeing the series as a whole after finishing the seventh season, where I went back to it and watched it and realized how many layers were in it and how many multiple connections you could see. And I feel like that's a sign of a great episode, a sign of a great show. And DS9 is definitely one of the best ones out of all of the Star Trek series to do that, where multiple viewings is needed to get all of the connections and layers. And that's why I think this episode is going to stand the test of time, not only for its message, which is timeless, but because you can watch it over and over again and find something new.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is one that I also fell in love with instantly, but I've grown to love it even more the more that I've watched it, just because of discovering something new that I didn't see before. Like all these layers that you were talking about, I see just how detailed and intricate and how well crafted this episode really is every time. The more I watch it, the more I love it. I can't do any wrong in my book. I think it's such a great message for Star Trek, for science fiction, for all of us. Yeah. It's incredible.
I'm starting to do a St. Crispin's Day speech about Far Beyond the Stars, and I'm totally on board with you. I want everyone to see this episode. You know, it almost works better on its own than as part of the overarching Dominion War plot. It's just such a good storyline. You know, we talked a little bit about the cops in the episode, and I just think they're such an integral part of showing the forces that Benny's up against. We never actually see Mr. Stone, this mysterious guy who pulps the whole run.
Yeah.
I would have liked to see a little bit with him, you know, maybe see Rene Auberjonois go up against him, you know, go toe-to-toe with him and say, no, we're printing it.
Well, it would have been great because we would have found out that Mr. Stone was actually Max Schrodinger.
Wouldn't that have been something?
I was going to say changeling, and she was hiding the fact that she was a female.
It was Kai Winn.
Oh, God.
Now, my child. We've already pulped the run.
She grabs his ear for some reason.
but they do have these two cops, and there's that Rodney King shot of them kicking Benny in the ground when he's just trying to get a look at what's happened to Sirik Lofton.
Yeah.
And it's so powerful and so sad. It's just, I don't know how anyone could see this episode and not be really moved and want to make a difference. You know, whatever we can do, you know, in the 21st century, I know we're now even 20 years removed from this episode being made, but there's still stuff that we can be working towards and making better. And this episode drives me to want to be a better person in whatever way I can.
Yeah, it is inspiring, isn't it?
It absolutely is, yeah.
Oh, it really is.
That's why I give it 10 robots out of 10.
I was going to give it 9 worms in the belly.
Nice.
It is inspiring on many different levels. Exactly what you're talking about there, Greg. And what always gets me, actually, at the end of this episode is the final line between the preacher and Benny. When he says, rest easy, Brother Benny, you have walked in the path of the prophets. There is no greater glory. And Sisko Benny asks him, tell me, please, who am I? And he says, don't you know? You are the dreamer and the dream. And, of course, Brock Peters' delivery of the lines really sell it. But just that part for me gets me every time this episode. And it's kind of a twist because it's the very, very ending of this episode is a little bit out of what happened all the way through. You know, Benny's journey, Sisko's journey as the emissary. And then you've got this final little message about just the simple idea of whether our reality is just a dream in someone else's mind or not. But even on that level, for me anyway, I find that kind of inspirational to think about. One of my final thoughts, Greg, was you mentioned that this works better as a standalone episode rather than part of the Dominion War arc. And I do agree with that. I think this does work as a standalone episode. What I'm impressed with with the DS9 writing staff is that they're able to take a story like this that's so completely different from everything else going on DS9, and they're still able to make it part of that arc, and they're still able to weave the prophets, Sisko's journey as emissary, the hardships of the war and how they affect our characters. They're still able to tie it all into that, especially at the beginning, so well. And I'm just impressed with the writing, as I always am on DS9, especially in the later seasons. So for me, this episode is, I think I probably have it in my top three DS9 episodes. It's definitely in my top 10, maybe 5 Star Trek episodes of all time. Without a doubt, I give this one 10 honeymoons on Andoris.
Nice.
Very good.
Tristan, I don't think we got a rating from you.
Oh, geez. I definitely give it a 9.5 awkwardly sexual praying mantises.
Excellent. That's a great rating. All right. Well, thanks for joining us for this discussion today, guys. Now, we have, of course, a whole Trek FM crew here. But, Tristan, tell everyone, if they want to find you, the international sex symbol, around the interwebs, where should they go?
Well, the most common place that you can find me is on Twitter at The Insane Robin. There I do the Star Trek question of the day every day, Monday through Friday, at about 10:30 a.m. Central.
Shortly to be followed by my Leffler answer of the day.
The always popular Leffler answer of the day. And you can also find me on To the Journey with my good friend.
To the Journey!
Exactly.
You caught me off guard there. I was ready a minute ago.
Just like the show, we keep you on your toes.
That's right.
And we discuss all things Star Trek Voyager with my good friend and co-host, Sharlin.
Yay! Yes. You can find me on To the Journey as well, and on
To the
Twitter.
Journey! To the Journey!
To the Journey!
It keeps getting worse and worse. Should we try again?
No, I think that was good.
And I'm also on the Twitter webs at Oh the Profanity, and then of course all over the place, Trek FM. I edit things, I write things, I do things, I manage things, sort of. I try, and that is that.
Well, you do an excellent job, Casey.
Thanks. Just don't tell anybody I'm a woman.
Don't worry, your secret is safe with me.
It's really nice this week, Chris, to get off of our heavy makeup. You got to take those ears off, and I got to not wear my false wig. I didn't realize how handsome Tristan was, not under that heavy blue makeup.
It is nice. Yeah, I feel relaxed this week. I feel like I can breathe easy. I can be myself out of the makeup. I'm glad we did this.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is a great idea. I think we should maybe start doing this podcast not in makeup. I know it might affect the verisimilitude of what's going on here, and we really want people, I think people can hear the makeup, right? For 83 episodes, people could hear that we were in makeup, right?
I think so. I think so. We'll have to check our mail and see how people felt we were this week compared to usual, you know,
right.
How did our out of makeup selves compare to our normal in makeup selves?
Definitely so.
But it was fun talking about Far Beyond the Stars. It's one of my absolute favorite episodes of Star Trek. It has been since the first time it aired. As I mentioned on the show, I read the novelization when it came out. Also excellent. I highly recommend you picking that up and reading that. And it's always a fun discussion. And again, I find as I watch this episode, I see more and more layers to it every time I watch it. And it's the beauty of great Star Trek.
Yeah, it's up there in one of my favorite DS9 episodes. Certainly one of my favorite of the away from the Star Trek universe episodes. I'm talking about Carbon Creek, 1159, City on the Edge. It's at the top of those, and certainly at the top of even my DS9 list. It's a great one. It's one that I recommend to people. Just, you really should just put on the Netflix and watch Far Beyond the Stars tonight, just for a taste of what DS9 really can do when it's firing on all cylinders.
Most definitely. Well, I imagine our audience will have some thoughts to share with us. So let's tell everyone how to contact us. Just go to trek.fm/contact, and there is a form there. You can send a message to the Ready Room, and that will come to Greg and me. You can find us over on Facebook, where we have a rapidly growing community, facebook.com/trekfm. And of course, you'll find us on Twitter under username trekfm, where we're talking about Star Trek all the time. Greg is there, I'm there, Char, and also Landrew, Drew Stewart, is there tweeting from that account. Now, Greg, what if people want to find you personally?
Well, they can find me on Twitter at Greg Harbin, where I talk about all sorts of things. Also posting Instagrams and Vines and all those sorts of crazy things. Also find me on the Observation Lounge every week with Catherine Bryan and the lovely Drew Stewart, where we talk about weekend geek news. It's a really fun hour-long show. If you just want to get, you know, a few things highlighted every week, it's a really, really fun show. I'm glad that it's on the Trek FM network.
You know, interestingly, on Twitter the other day, Drew was voted as the person with the best hair on yes. Trek FM, as well as the most dulcet tones, the best voice on Trek FM, which was yes. interesting.
People love it. Yes, I've heard reviews of my show that basically were, Drew sounds like a nice boy. It's like, okay, all right, thank you. All right,
he's
I'll pass
a very
that along.
Nice boy. All right, well, if you want to find me, I'm on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username. And of course, I talk about Star Trek. I also talk about music and design and sports ball and Japan and all sorts of things. So give me a follow and send me an at reply and say hello. I do love to chat. And let's also take a moment, Greg, and say thank you to our sponsor, Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way and the best way to create personal blogs or the largest websites that you can possibly think of. The technology is fantastic. It's very modern. It gives you an easy way to build websites right in your browser that look beautiful on the desktop and automatically reflow for mobile devices. And you could even push your content out to social media as you publish posts. It's really fantastic. So check it out. Go over to squarespace.com/trek, and you can use offer code TREK1 to get 10% off of their already very low prices. And you'll be supporting our sponsor, and you'll be supporting Trek FM at the same time. We really appreciate their support. All right, Greg. Well, I think it's time to let everyone go. I'm going to wander off and check out one of Willie's baseball games.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick a worm in it, because the Ready Room is done.
Lester Young, ladies and gentlemen, Lester Young.
No. We're going to try one more time.
Okay.
You can find me and Tristan on To the Journey.
To the Journey!
To the Journey!
To the Journey!
How was that, Sean?
Yay! No. All right, moving on.